Now, an interfaith group in Milwaukee has launched a new campaign called We All Belong. They say their primary goals are to protect democracy, build community, and reject what they see as a rising tide of Christian nationalism. The campaign defines Christian nationalism as, quote, a political ideology that merges Christian and American identities. According to the group, which includes a number of Christian faith leaders and others, Christian nationalism is not in keeping with the foundational teachings of the Christian faith, such as rejecting wealth and power or caring for the poor and marginalized. Two of those Christian faith leaders join us now to talk about why they believe opposing Christian nationalism is so important and urgent. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the role of faith in civic life? What would you like to see from local religious leaders? Do you have concerns, as our guests do, about what appears to be a rise in Christian nationalism? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Pastor Richard D. Shaw is president of Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope, known as MICA, and pastor at St. Matthew Christian Methodist Episcopal Church. Pastor Shaw, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Also with us, Bishop Paul Erickson, Bishop of the Greater Milwaukee Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Bishop Erickson, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Good to be with you.
Pastor Shaw, can you talk about what led you and the members of MICA to take up Christian nationalism as a major issue right now?
Yes. Thank you again for having us. We look across our country and observe things that are going on, and we see this rise in Christian nationalism and the danger that it imposes on the lives of people who do not fit under that umbrella. And MICA is an interfaith organization, so we are a community of our own. And so when we witness these things that are happening in our country, it just behooved us to get involved with this. And we understand the threat of Christian nationalism and the danger that it not only brings to our democracy, but also to people as a whole.
And Bishop Erickson, could you talk about your involvement with MICA and with this effort against Christian nationalism?
Yeah, thank you so much. I've been involved with MICA in various capacities over the years. And as we saw the rise in hate crimes and violence against non-Christian groups, our Jewish and Muslim and Sikh siblings, the kind of anti-immigrant rhetoric that was on the rise, both locally and across the country, it seemed to me that we needed to stand up and stand together and say very clearly that this is a country built on diversity of opinions and belief and faiths, that we can all work together to make this world a place in which, indeed, we all belong.
And Pastor Shaw, can you talk about the membership of MICA and the We All Belong effort? You're both leaders in Christian denominations. Can you talk about the mix in this group?
Yes. Again, we're interfaith. We have congregations from Muslim congregations, Jewish congregations. We have Buddhists. We have across the board. So we really do aim to build this community where, although we may have some differences in our traditions, but we find this common place that we meet, and it's around justice and standing up for those things that threaten our democracy and people, and those things that go against the very fabric of America. When we talk about freedom of religion, we live that out through MICA in terms of creating a community where we respect one another and our different beliefs.
Bishop Erickson, I know that within congregations, it isn't always a popular decision for faith leaders to get involved in politics one way or another. What kind of response have you gotten from your congregation with your involvement in this effort?
Well, as I've received nothing but supportive comments in the recent weeks, especially since the press conference that we held to kick this off last week, Thursday. And I think it's important to recognize that even though we strongly encourage people of all faiths and of no faith to engage in the civic arena, to engage in politics, we certainly need to avoid being partisan in that regard, favoring one side over the other or one politician over the other. But certainly Christians need to engage and use our voices to influence the way our world is shaped, to create the beloved community in which all people have what they need to live a full and dignified life.
We're talking to Bishop Paul Erickson with the Greater Milwaukee Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America and Pastor Richard D. Shaw with the St. Matthew Christian Methodist Episcopal Church. They're both part of the group MICA and the campaign We All Belong, raising concerns about Christian nationalism in the United States. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Pastor Shaw, getting into specific concerns about the ideas of Christian nationalism, as I understand it, you and your fellow Christian members of this group are concerned that there's a misuse, I guess, of the Christian name, of the Christian identity going on here. What are your concerns?
Yes. The first concern is that when you misrepresent something, it can be very dangerous. It also can lead people into being involved in something that they may not necessarily realize that they're involved in. What I mean by that is when you take an ideology and you wrap it in a faith's name, such as Christianity, some may only hear the word Christian and begin to take part of it, not realizing the agenda that is attached to that. I oftentimes say that it's an agenda that is wrapped up in Christian language that is very dangerous and alarming. And so one of the things that MICA strives to do is to bring this awareness to our congregation. And when I say congregations, not just Christian congregations, but congregations across the board, to bring this awareness, to be able to recognize it and then see how we can come together to combat this.
I want to give a listen to a Southern Baptist, longtime Southern Baptist leader, Russell Moore, recently removed as a leader within the Southern Baptist Convention. He was speaking in an interview with NPR's All Things Considered earlier this week about why he's concerned about the direction of his faith community.
Well, it was the result of having multiple pastors tell me essentially the same story about quoting the Sermon on the Mount, parenthetically, in their preaching. Turn the other cheek. To have someone come up after and say, where did you get those liberal talking points? And what was alarming to me is that in most of these scenarios, when the pastor would say, I'm literally quoting Jesus Christ, the response would not be, I apologize. The response would be, yes, but that doesn't work anymore. That's weak. And when we get to the point where the teachings of Jesus himself are seen as subversive to us, then we're in a crisis.
I wanted to get your reactions to that. Bishop Erickson, first of all, what do you think hearing that anecdote related?
Well, that resonates with my own experience hearing pastors who were invited to preach on the Beatitudes because it came up in the assigned series of readings shortly after the inauguration of our previous president, and they were accused of going down a liberal path. So that does definitely resonate with our experience in our congregations. And I think we really need to remember that the scripture focuses on love of neighbor and that there are many different ways to love our neighbor, but we have to be involved in the civic arena and involved in caring for the least, the lost, and those people who are cast out.
And Pastor Shaw, your thoughts of what we heard from Russell Moore there?
Yes, we've experienced that within our denomination as well. A predominantly Black organization, but oftentimes what you hear is the language of evangelical thoughts and ideas that comes forth. And so, yes, those conversations take place within our denomination, especially when you are dealing with topics that are very sensitive politically, such as abortion and same-sex marriage. And so when you begin to bring the Bible in and condemn people because of how you interpret scripture, that leads to more division.
We're talking to Pastor Richard D. Shaw and Bishop Paul Erickson from the group Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope about their newly launched campaign against Christian nationalism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you belong to a religious community? How are issues of politics dealt with within your congregation? Are they dealt with within your congregation? Do you want to see faith leaders get involved in advocating on issues? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Bishop Paul Erickson and Pastor Richard D. Shaw from the group Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope about their campaign to oppose Christian nationalism. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Does your faith affect your politics, how you vote, how you get involved maybe in advocating for or against things? Do you want to see faith leaders take stances on these issues? Are you concerned about Christian nationalism? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Chris is with us in Black River Falls. Chris, hi.
Hi. While listening to the conversation here, and I can sympathize with the guest's point of view, I am glad to see everybody in my community to be the best person in that part of that community that they can possibly be. But on the other hand, I am diametrically opposed to the injection of one's faith into politics in any form. I feel that we must use kind of a logic and reason-based approach to politics, and one's religion is their own personal beliefs. They're welcome to it. But as a community, we must make the best informed decision that we can, not based in fact, not on faith.
Chris, thanks for the call. Based on fact, not in faith. Pastor Shaw, what do you think of what Chris had to say?
You know, I think it's almost impossible, and this is just my view, to separate our faith from any decisions that we make in life. Although we know that we don't want our faith to control others, but how we respond. And so when we're looking at Christian nationalism, again, and I use this word dangerous because it is because if you have a certain group who's interpreting scripture in a way that is oppressive and it's a way that in a way that is exclusive, you have to have that conversation along those lines. So if one is using their version of Christianity for a political movement, and the church is not just the church, but congregations, the faith community is real, then we also have to pull from our belief systems, not trying to control government, but at least sending the message that we should make our decisions in a caring and compassionate way.
Thanks for that call, Chris. And Bishop Erickson, that reminds me, one of the themes in the We All Belong campaign is breaking the silence. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think we sometimes interpret the fact that my faith is my personal belief is that I should remain silent in the public arena. I do believe that my faith impacts every single thing I do, so I cannot engage in the public arena without bringing my faith. I cannot, however, impose my faith on others. And so as I engage in those conversations, I need to speak my truth, but then I need to listen to the other truths. So our congregations, I think, are too often afraid to talk about potentially controversial topics, and they just want to push those aside and sweep them under the rug and let's just sing happy songs and not go down any controversial road. I think we need to have these robust conversations in our congregations and in our communities so that we can listen to and learn from each other.
Let's go to another caller now. Garrett is with us in Wausau. Garrett, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I've talked to many other Christians who are kind of saddened by what seems to be the co-opting of their religion with politics. And so I'm wondering how you separate the use of religion within politics, or perhaps the co-opting of religious beliefs within politics, with Christian nationalism specifically. Thank you.
Garrett, thanks for the call, Pastor Shaw. I think, Garrett, wondering, you know, how could you be involved? How could you bring your Christianity into politics without crossing the line into what you see happening in Christian nationalism?
Well, it's more so for me living it out. You live it out, and the message is sent through how we respond to situations in life, how we look at society. And again, it's about creating a beloved community. It's not about imposing. As Bishop Erickson said, it's not about controlling, but it is about sending a message that we can coexist, that we can live together, and we can bring our faith into this. And as a matter of fact, I want to be clear that there are those that side with us. They may not necessarily be a part of Michael, which they're welcome in terms of taking a stance with us, who are atheists. It's all about addressing an issue that uses Christianity to push a political agenda to control society. So, and that's where the religious community has to step up to speak against this.
Thanks again for that call. Bishop Erickson, one of the concerns raised in the press conference we mentioned earlier is that you see Christian nationalism potentially as a threat to democracy, to our representative form of government in the United States. Can you connect the dots for us?
I'll do my best. I think there is a fear that when one tries to communicate that in order to be a good American, you have to be Christian, and that Americans should be led by Christians only, that's a dangerous path to go down. And that is contrary to our understanding of a healthy democracy in which people of all faiths and no faiths engage together in the public arena, sharing their views and working together. My view in public engagement is shaped by the book of Micah, chapter 6, verse 8. We are called to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with our God. We have forgotten that third one so often. We are too many folks are lack humility in the public arena.
We are talking to Bishop Paul Erickson and Pastor Richard D. Shaw, both with the Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope, looking at their campaign to draw attention to concerns about Christian nationalism. It's called We All Belong. Back to your calls now. Jane is with us in Oconomowoc. Jane, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One thing that I would like to point out, my faith tells me that Jesus was radical. He was radically inclusive, radically supportive, radically loving of everyone, including those who did not love him. And so I, as a Christian, must live out my faith with that radical idea that everyone belongs and everyone deserves a voice.
Jane, thanks for the call. Pastor Shaw.
Yes, I could not agree with her more. Oftentimes we want to present Christ in a way that, and I'll just say dominant society or Christianity has shaped this image of having to be a certain way in order to be Christian. But the thing about it is, Jesus commanded us to love our neighbors, commanded us to love our neighbors, and his work while he existed here definitely spoke against even the powers that existed at that time. And so, as a faith community today, and I'm drawing from my Christian belief, is that we have to do the same. We have to do the same. And so I do agree with the call.
And Bishop Erickson, your reaction?
I would just say amen. We are called to be radically inclusive, and that means listening to and engaging with folks from all different perspectives. I mean, even within the Christian faith, there is a strong diversity of opinions and views. We don't always agree on everything, even within our own house. So we need to engage in deep, deep listening and conversation, starting from a premise that everyone belongs and everyone's voice matters.
Pastor Shaw, do you see room for a group like yours to talk to leaders who might put themselves in this Christian nationalist camp, or whether they call it by that name or not? Do you see opportunity for a productive dialogue?
I would hope. And that's going to be the key, productive dialogue and sitting down and being willing to hear one another. Although I'm somewhat skeptical, but I do believe that it is possible. And that's what we have to do. We have to try to get people to come to the table and talk about it. Because again, it goes back to my first statement. I do think that there are some people who subscribe to it without all of the details and not realizing what they have involved themselves into, because they want to be faithful, and I put that in quotations, to what they believe.
I want to talk about some recent unfortunate trends in Wisconsin. We see year after year, unfortunately, yet another report released finding that anti-Semitic incidents in particular on the rise in Wisconsin for the seventh consecutive year. Bishop Erickson, I know there are Jewish leaders prominent in your movement as well. What do you talk to your congregation about specifically when it comes to anti-Semitic incidents?
Well, certainly we need to stand with our Jewish siblings and stand against anti-Semitism and hatred of all forms. There just recently some flyers that were handed out in the community of Sussex, and we need to find ways to stand with our folks and recognize that we are all children of the same loving God. And we cannot be driven by fear and hatred and a misunderstanding of difference. We need to embrace difference. And even if we don't understand one another, we can stand together and work together.
And in just our last minute or so, Pastor Shaw, on a practical level, what is in the coming year for this campaign?
We just want to make sure that we get as many congregations involved as possible. The idea is that if we can bring this awareness, and then that will begin the process of addressing it. Just keeping focus on the idea of building a beloved community. And it's the community that Dr. Martin Luther King spoke about, not one that is exclusive, but one that is inclusive, diverse, and it welcomes and embodies all people.
Pastor Shaw, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Bishop Erickson, thanks for being with us. Thank you. We've been talking to Pastor Richard Shaw, president of Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope, known as MICA, and pastor at St. Matthew Christian Methodist Episcopal Church, and Bishop Paul Erickson, bishop of the Greater Milwaukee Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Been talking about their interfaith work, speaking out against white Christian nationalism, which they see as a major political issue ahead of the 2024 presidential election. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it all started at a summer party in the Bronx in 1973. Join 1A for a celebration of hip-hop. Jen White shares your stories and favorite tracks, and here's how this cultural force has been shaping what we've been listening to for the last 50 years. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, mourners gathered in Ireland earlier this week to pay their respects to singer and songwriter Sinead O'Connor, who died last month at age 56. That's Sinead O'Connor singing Nothing Compares to You, which topped the Billboard charts in 1990 and remains her biggest hit. The Irish singer had a successful career and an international fan base, but her music was often overshadowed by headline-grabbing controversies, like when she ripped a picture of Pope John Paul II on Saturday Night Live in 1992 to protest abuse in the Catholic Church. As with many artists, Sinead O'Connor leaves behind a complicated legacy, but it's one that's important to talk about and remember, according to our guest today, a music journalist who wrote a book about O'Connor, published earlier this year, just weeks before the singer's passing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you listen to Sinead O'Connor? What does her music mean to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Allison McCabe is a music journalist and author of Why Sinead O'Connor Matters. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, and thanks to the listeners for joining us.
You were clearly very invested in Sinead O'Connor's life and writing this book, a lot of personal connections there. I want to start off by asking, how did the news of her passing hit you?
Shock. I mean, you know, I was very, very shocked because although, she's had many hardships, she was coming back into the public eye. If anybody out there watches the show Outlander, she did the theme music. She was working on a new album. She was back on social media on the platform formerly known as Twitter. And, it really seemed like she was coming back, as she has so many times before. So, yes, it was shocking and also gutting.
I want to talk about her music specifically a little bit, which often, you write, got overshadowed by various controversies. But you write this amazing story, like you see in the movies in some ways, of, hey, this kid's really talented, and somebody hears her and tells somebody else, and then all of a sudden she's an international superstar. There's this huge well of talent at the center of her story. Can you talk about that a little?
I mean, there really is. And I think that gets overlooked a little bit because, you know, a lot of people really only know a very limited number of things about her. You know, they know that her hair was shaved. She had a 1990 mega hit with Nothing Compares to You, which she started at the top of the program. And as you mentioned, 2 years later, she goes on Saturday Night Live and she destroyed a photograph of Pope John Paul II. And after that, she really, for a lot of people, except for people who are sort of super fans, she disappears from the world stage. And, you know, then all we hear from her really after that is nonstop tabloid headlines that have nothing to do with her music. That was really why I became interested in her story. I wanted to go back and figure out how that happened. And I reexamined her interviews and her public statements. But also, as you're talking about here, I went back to her music. And long after she stopped making chart hits, she made gorgeous, amazing music. She's done 10 studio albums in addition to compilations, live albums, songs for films and TV, charity appearances, and so on. She really did have this voice that it was, you know, whether you want to call it innate or use religious terms and call it God-given, her voice really had the power to express an emotional truth. And I think that's what people have responded to over all these years. And that was discovered early on when she was about 13 or 14. She was in a Catholic girls' reform school following her parents' divorce. Her mother had been very abusive to her in her childhood. But at that school, she met a kindly nun who saw that she had this need to express herself and bought her a guitar and arranged for lessons and really sort of saw her for the first time. I mean, by that, really saw that she had this need, really, to have an emotional outlet, but also that she could maybe be that for other people. And that's what people saw over and over again. And that's why she was signed to her first recording contract when she was only in her teens.
I want to skip ahead to another album here. 1994, the album's Universal Mother. Here's a listen to the song, a song about the Irish famine.
Okay, I want to talk about Ireland. Specifically, I want to talk about the famine, about the fact that there never really was one. There was no famine. See, Irish people were only allowed to eat potatoes. All of the other food, meat, fish, vegetables, was shipped out of the country under armed guard to England while the Irish people started.
Famine by Sinead O'Connor. And Allison, you know, the president of Ireland was at Sinead O'Connor's funeral, a huge part of Irish culture. As you write, Sinead O'Connor wasn't a singer who happened to be from Ireland. There was something very central about her Irish identity. Can you talk about that and how it shaped her career?
Right. So from very early on, you know, she really wanted to be a protest singer. You know, Nothing Compares to You was kind of an outlier. You know, she saw herself in this great Irish tradition of sort of agitator artists. And then, you know, within the sort of rock music world, you know, her inspirations were really people like Bob Dylan or John Lennon or Bob Marley. The problem she faced was that as a young woman, you know, who this is in the 1980s when she signed her first recording contract, there's just not really an established lane for young female artists to do that. But the Irishness really does come through from the start, and it is a through line in her work. And actually, you know, you mentioned Universal Mother, which is one of my favorite of her albums. It's really not until after 1992, which she says re-railed rather than derailed her career because it set her back on the path of making music with meaning, that she stopped suppressing her Irish accent. And she goes back to Ireland and she studies this method of singing called bel canto, which isn't about breathing or formal techniques. It's about really using your what's within you, you know, your experiences, your perspectives, your emotions to get to the fullest and truest sense of the music. And that also came out in songs like the one you just played.
Yeah, and I read that she went through that training. It seemed to me like she was already pretty good at doing that, right? Like expressing emotion and her experience through her voice came through pretty loud and clear on her first couple albums, right?
Yes, but she was actually encouraged by her label, you know, to suppress her Irish accent because the idea was that that wasn't going to sell in America. And to be an international superstar, you had to sell in America. There are also two different album covers for that record, which, by the way, she's about 20 or 21, just about to turn 21 when that album comes out. She's produced that album by herself. They had another producer on there and she felt that, you know, that wasn't really her creative vision. So she took over the production herself. But when it came time to release it, they did a photo shoot, and the original album cover, which was released in Europe, you can see this online, her mouth is open in song. And they said, oh, you know, you look too angry for American audiences. Let's try another shot. So that's the one we got, where she's looking downward with her arms crossed in front of her chest.
One thing that kept hitting me through the book is it seemed like Sinead O'Connor had her vision of why she made music, what she was doing, what it did for her, what she was trying to do for the audiences. And then there is this vision of what it meant to be a celebrity at that time, especially a woman celebrity at that time. And they just never meshed. They really, it seems like that was at the center of a lot of what ended up being controversy. Am I reading that right?
Well, absolutely. Because even before, you know, Saturday Night Live, you know, when she, in 1990, this is when she has that big mega hit and this multi-platinum selling album, you know, she's being criticized for really many, many things. I mean, you know, there's an earlier appearance that she was supposed to do in 1990 on Saturday Night Live. And she found out that Andrew Dice Clay was going to host the episode. And both she and the cast member Nora Dunn both pulled out of the episode because they objected to his humor, which many consider to be misogynistic and homophobic. And they responded by having an opening skit where Nora Dunn is crushed to death by Sinead's falling amplifier. And Andrew Dice Clay calls her the bald chick. You know, that was 90. Also, a few months later, she's going to play a show in New Jersey at the Garden State Art Center. And it was the custom at that venue to play the national anthem before the show. Two people who were posing as reporters, they weren't actually reporters, sort of baited her by asking her about her feelings about whether or not it should be played. And she expressed her preference that it not be played because I think she was sort of unclear as to what that had to do with the, you know, rock music that she was going to be playing. And they ran with that to a local station. It got reported that she refused to play because she was anti-American and she was censoring the national anthem. So all these things happened before SNL. And when SNL happened, you got the sense that, you know, she'd done this thing that was shocking, but really people weren't necessarily talking about why she did it, which was to call attention to the child abuse crisis in the Catholic Church, which actually was real.
Talking to Allison McCabe, music journalist, author of the new book, Why Sinead O'Connor Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you'd like. What are your opinions on Sinead O'Connor? Were you watching all this happen back in the day? Have your feelings changed over the years? And do you just like listening to her music? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. That's Sinead O'Connor singing the Sky Boat song for the title credits of the TV show Outlander. Allison McCabe stays with us, author of the new book, Why Sinead O'Connor Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did Sinead O'Connor matter to you? What do you think is her legacy in music, in politics, in pop culture? Do you have questions for our guest about Sinead O'Connor's music, life, or activism? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Allison, you write about Sinead O'Connor's lifelong struggle with the trauma you mentioned earlier, her abuse as a child. This comes back again and again, seeking therapy in various ways. And it seems, unfortunately, like she never, I don't know how she could, but it seemed like she never escaped that.
Yeah, I mean, again, after Saturday Night Live, she didn't disappear. She kept making music, but we weren't really listening. And she kept trying to talk about issues such as racism and sexism. And, you know, she was early on talking about HIV/AIDS awareness. She was talking about all kinds of social issues, but we were not really listening. And one of those issues, of course, was talking about her lifelong struggles with mental health. And again, we didn't listen. You know, many people wrote her off as crazy and they used her candid disclosures to discredit or invalidate her. And I think that's really tragic.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi, Rob. So I was not a huge, I was born in 79. I grew up in the 80s and 90s. I was never a huge Sinead O'Connor fan. I went to a Catholic church. The priest there was fantastic. But given the totality of everything that has occurred in other portions of the Catholic Church, I feel like she's been vindicated and that it's shown her actions, although some might have deemed them rather drastic, that she was calling very loudly attention to an issue which we're still grappling with today. And so I think she was really at the forefront of it. And so therefore I have much respect for her.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that call. Allison, this is something people are talking a lot about, that Sinead O'Connor was right at the time with her protests against abuse and cover-ups of that abuse in the Catholic Church. It just took the rest of us a long time to catch up with her.
Well, you know, again, I think, you know, she didn't always say things perfectly, right? And the message didn't always land. And, you know, she didn't come on the show and say, hey, this is why I'm tearing the photograph, mm-hmm. and explain it in very explicit terms. And I think a lot of people just didn't understand what she was trying to do at that moment. And you know, she loved the Catholic Church. You know, remember, when she goes to the school, even though the school was a harsh school, you know, that's where she found her voice. You know, it was the love of this nun, Sister Margaret, you know, who loved her, you know, gave her the love that her mother never gave her, you know, really was a figure like that for her. That's where she really, it's where everything sort of came together. So when she tore up that photograph, she did not mean at all to attack the faith. What she meant to do was call attention to the corruption and the hypocrisy of an institution that was protecting predators and silencing survivors. You know, about 10 years later, a series of articles comes out in the Boston Globe. And, you know, that is a sort of major turning point in the U.S. in terms of public opinion about what was going on. People were suddenly aware, this is real, this is happening. It's not isolated to a few cases, right? But it's global. And it's not, by the way, just the Catholic Church either. You know, people started to see that. And it was reporting. As a journalist, I respect that. I respect the meticulous reporting. But it was also the bravery of those survivors under intense pressure to remain silent, you know, and keep the shame inside, to say something anyhow, you know, to say something, to talk and to be heard. And that's where we start to see change.
Marcus, thanks for that call. And I saw, Allison, quotes from people attending Sinead O'Connor's funeral, some of them abuse survivors themselves, talking about what hearing Sinead O'Connor talk about abuse meant to them. This is something that even if everybody wasn't listening, some people it clearly reached.
It did. And you know, I think over the past, you know, year or 2 years already, this narrative was starting to shift. You know, we started to see this. Of course, you know, her memoir came out in 2021. And that's how I first connected with her. I had an advanced copy of that memoir. I pitched a story to NPR's Morning Edition, a profile about Sinead O'Connor, interviewed her for that. And really, I mean, I love making stories for radio, because what I get to do is I get to have the interview with the principal subject, in this case, Sinead O'Connor. I also brought in outside voices, a musician, a music critic. I got to put her music in there. I got to put some archival tape in there. I got to bring context to her story. But realistically, you have about 5 minutes to do that. It's like a miniature documentary. So I knew even at that time, there was a much bigger story, and that's why I wanted to write the book. So her memoir came out in 2021. And then in 2022, Catherine Ferguson made the documentary Nothing Compares. And then my book came out in May. So this narrative was beginning to shift, you know, already. And now it's really, I think, a positive thing that it's continuing to shift. I just wish that she could have experienced more of that love in her lifetime.
Allison McCabe is with us, author of the new book, Why Sinead O'Connor Matters. So we got another caller. Patrick is with us in Madison. Patrick, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to bring up, sorry, I'm in the car. I just wanted to bring up, I interviewed Sinead O'Connor in 1988 in Detroit, Michigan. And that was her first time over in the States. And right away, we were a college radio station. And so we were always looking for artists that, you know, just had a certain voice, certain message. And I was just very impressed by her thoughts about things, her thoughts about the world and things in general. And, you know, for me, I think when she did what she did with the Pope on Saturday Night Live, for me, I was impressed that, you know, she was dealing with fame in a way that she wasn't aware of, and just the backlash of the music industry in general. You know, it just shows how relevant she was then and how relevant she is now.
Patrick, thanks for the call. Allison, what do you think?
Well, first of all, Patrick, thank you for seeing it early on. You know, I mean, she really, it was MTV and college and sort of alternative radio in its infancy. That's where she first came to the attention of people in the US and people like Patrick who saw it, you know, that this wasn't just an entertainer, this was an artist. And I think there's a big distinction. You know, what she showed us throughout her career as a musician, throughout her life, was that the real enemy was really our apathy and our indifference and our tendency to isolate and shame people who show us uncomfortable truths. You know, so I think now I don't think of her as a saint. I think of her as a human, as someone who, you know, she doesn't have to be perfect. None of us are perfect. But what set her apart was that she never gave up on the idea that the conversations she tried to spark were worth having.
Thanks for that call, Patrick. Let's listen to another piece from your favorite album, Universal Mother. This is from In This Heart.
This is my
Allison, could you talk about that track a little?
You know, I was just listening to it. I mean, even though I've heard it so many times before, it's just so beautiful. It sort of stops you in your tracks. You know, I mean, I think thinking about it now in terms of her legacy, I think that the best way that we can honor that legacy is to, you know, understand, again, that this was a human, that this was an artist, and also that this was somebody who was, you know, committed to talking about issues, especially those that are most difficult for us. I mean, we don't have to agree, but building bridges is better than burning them, and listening is better than silencing.
I've been trying to think of artists that I put in a category with Sinead O'Connor, and my list is zero. Allison, she's such a unique voice. Do you categorize her with anyone else, or does nothing compare to her?
Yeah, I think that's come up a few times when people have talked about, you know, the title of that song. And is there anybody who compares to Sinead? I mean, she was a singular talent, but I do think she created many lanes for other artists. I'm thinking about, you know, some of the songs she was expressing pain and anger. And then, you see that in artists who came after, like Hole, or, you know, you think about Alanis Morissette in a song like You Oughta Know. You know, she made that lane possible. You know, you're talking about artists who are again, you know, I think that there's a little bit of a double standard in the sense that male artists, it was okay to sort of have an activist orientation. But for female artists, he really made that possible in a way that wasn't possible before so much, right? I mean, people still encounter resistance and that double standard is still there, but she at least sort of charted the path in that sense. But I do think that there really is one Sinead O'Connor, and you know, really nothing does compare.
And just our last few moments, I know the late 80s, early 90s were an abysmal time for to be a woman in the music business. Are things at least a little better because of her and what she went through?
I'd like to think so. I mean, I think they're different. You know, I think that artists today face all kinds of different challenges, regardless of their gender, you know, just because, she came up during what I would call monoculture, when for everybody was watching, let's say, the Grammys, or everybody was watching Saturday Night Live all at the same time on television. You know, now we live in a kind of social media environment where things go by so quickly and things are so ephemeral. You know, whatever statement you're making creatively, politically, in any regard, it's harder to kind of have that stick because there's always the demand for the next, you know?
Allison, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
That's Allison McCabe, music journalist, author of the book Why Sinead O'Connor Matters. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get the latest on the Wisconsin Republicans who signed a statement saying they were the electors in the 2020 elections and the legal questions surrounding the so-called fake electors in this state and around the country. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with an expert on marinades. We'll clear up some common mistakes that I've probably made and find out how to make the most of the marinating process tomorrow on Central Time.